The Agentic Memory Reading Path, 4 of 5. Imagine two memory systems. You run them on the same benchmark, with the same retrieval, the same queries, everything identical, and depending on a single choice you make in the scoring script, a choice most papers don't even mention, System A wins or System B wins. Not a small wobble. The ranking flips on up to 94% of the queries. That is a real result from a 2026 paper, and it means something uncomfortable. A large fraction of the memory leaderboards you have seen could be reversed by a decision the authors made silently and never reported. This episode is about the measurement crisis, not as a complaint, but as a craft, because the same researchers exposing how the numbers lie are also telling you exactly how to measure honestly. Welcome back to the Agentic Memory Deep Dive. This is episode 4. Every episode so far has ended by pointing here. The foundations flagged that single success numbers hide failures. The systems episode showed a benchmark so easy a dumb baseline nearly won it. The procedural episode showed that what looks like skill formation is often just the base model in disguise. All of those are the same disease. We are bad at measuring memory, and the badness is not random. It systematically flatters whatever we built. Today, three 2026 papers, each exposing a different failure of measurement, and each prescribing the fix. First, a paper called Same Ranking, Different Winner, on how the choice of scoring target silently flips conclusions. Second, MemConflict, on how answer-level scores hide retrieval failures. Third, Harness Updating is Not Harness Benefit, on how we confuse changing an agent with improving it. And we will ground all of it in two industry efforts to put agent reliability on a scientific footing. This is the most important episode in the series for anyone who has to trust a number. Start with the paper that opened the episode, by Sugam Panthi and Rabab Abdel Fattah, titled Same Ranking, Different Winner: How Scoring Targets Shape LLM Memory Benchmarks. The setup is a situation we built up over the last two episodes. Modern memory systems transform a single conversation, turn into multiple descendants, the raw turn, a summary, an extracted atomic fact, a timeline entry. All of those can live in the retrieval index at once. So when you score retrieval, you have to answer a question almost nobody answers out loud: which stored form counts as the correct thing to retrieve? The authors define three possible scoring targets. Raw: credit the system for retrieving the original turn. Source: credit it for retrieving anything source-linked to the answer. Canonical: credit it for retrieving the clean, distilled canonical fact. And they built a tool called TIAP that takes already saved ranked outputs and rescores them under each of the three targets, without rerunning retrieval at all. Same retrieval behavior, three different definitions of correct, and you watch what happens to the rankings. What happens is carnage for anyone who trusts leaderboards. On the two standard benchmarks, LOCOMO and LongMemEval, switching only the credited target changes the NDCG score on between 83 and 94% of shared queries. It flips the ordering between systems on real transfer runs, MemZero and MemoryOS change places. It even reverses design recommendations. The advice about how dense your memory parser should be inverts depending on the scoring target. And then they did a careful semantic audit of 1,900 plus cases and found that the relaxed, generous, source-linked credit was actually fully justified only about 29% of the time, even though the scoring rubric itself was highly reliable. There's a subtler trap the same paper surfaces, and it's one to watch for everywhere in evaluation: the coverage confound. Different scoring targets don't just change scores, they change which queries are even answerable. And comparing systems over different query populations confounds the result with how hard those particular queries were. The authors found that queries which have a clean canonical target are intrinsically easier under the raw scoring, so if you don't restrict the comparison to a shared, coverage-matched set of queries, you can credit a system for being good when it was just being graded on easier questions. The discipline that fixes it: only compare on the queries all systems actually had a fair shot at, and justify your retrieval depth, the K in top K, against where recall actually plateaus rather than picking it to flatter your numbers. They call this target non-invariance, and the phrase is worth keeping. It means your conclusion about which memory architecture is better is not invariant to a benchmark design choice that is usually left implicit. The fix is almost embarrassingly simple, and almost never done. Define your scoring target explicitly and report it. And note how they earned the right to make that claim, because it models good practice. They validated their scoring rubric against human labels on a stratified subset, reaching strong inter-rater agreement, before running a 5-model majority vote at temperature zero across all 1900 cases. They calibrated the judge before trusting it. If a paper or a vendor shows you a memory benchmark and cannot tell you what counted as a correct retrieval, the number is not interpretable. Full stop. The second paper attacks a different illusion, that getting the right answer means the memory worked. MemConflict by Zhen Tao and colleagues treats memory validity not as a static property, but as what they call a query-conditioned fitness-for-use problem. A memory isn't just true or false, it's fit or unfit for this particular question right now. To test that, MemConflict deliberately manufactures conflict. It simulates long-horizon histories from structured user profiles, injects cross-session conflicts where a later fact contradicts an earlier one, and seeds in semantically similar distractors, plausible-looking wrong memories that compete for retrieval. The distractor design is the clever part, a distractor about a closely related entity, similar enough to fool a cosine search but wrong, so that a system relying purely on embedding similarity gets pulled toward it. It formalizes three kinds of conflict, and each is a real production failure. Dynamic conflicts are about temporal validity. The fact was true, then it changed, which is true now. Static conflicts are about plain factual correctness among competing claims. Conditional conflicts are about contextual applicability. The memory is true but does not apply to this particular question. Then it evaluates two ways at once. Black box, did the final answer come out right? White box, did the system actually retrieve and rank the correct supporting memory, separately scored from whether the answer happened to be right? And the central finding is the one to internalize. Across 6 representative long-term memory systems, answer correctness often diverges from memory retrieval and ranking. A system can produce the right answer while having retrieved the wrong evidence or ranked the correct memory far down the list. It got lucky, or it pattern matched, or the base model filled the gap. If you only looked at the answer, you would conclude the memory worked. The white box view shows it didn't. The diagnostics pin the failures down. Sometimes the supporting memory is missing entirely. Sometimes it's retrieved but used ineffectively. And the sensitivity analysis is a list of everything that makes real deployments hard. Longer histories, distractors, implicit queries, and larger conflict distances all degrade performance. Put TIAP and MemConflict together, and you have the two halves of the white box argument. TIAP says, be explicit about what counts as the right memory. MemConflict says, check whether you actually retrieved it, separately from whether the answer was right. Both are reactions to the same bad habit, scoring only the final answer, which is the memory equivalent of grading a student only on the final number, and never checking whether they understood the problem or just copied the back of the book. The third paper, by Minhua Lin and colleagues, has the bluntest title in the series, Harness Updating is Not Harness Benefit, and it goes after the most seductive illusion of all, the one underneath the entire self-improving agent narrative. Here's the setup. Modern agents are built around an editable harness. The prompts, the skills, the memories, the tools, everything outside the model waits that shapes how it behaves. Self-evolving agents update that harness from their own execution history, and the field cheers when the score goes up after an update. But the authors ask a question almost nobody separates out. There are two completely different capabilities hiding in self-evolution. One, harness updating, the ability to produce useful, persistent updates to the harness. Two, harness benefit, the ability to actually benefit from an updated harness when solving a task. Those are not the same skill, and conflating them is everywhere. Their findings are genuinely surprising. First, harness updating is flat across model capability. Models from wildly different capability tiers produce harness updates that yield surprisingly similar gains. In their striking example, updates produced by a small 9 billion parameter model yielded gains comparable to updates produced by a frontier model like Claude Opus. The cheap model writes about as useful a skill or memory as the expensive one. Second, harness benefit is non-monotonic. Weak models benefit little from a good harness, mid-tier models benefit the most, and strong models benefit less than mid-tier. They trace the weak-tier failure to two causes. Weak models either fail to activate the relevant harness artifact at all, or they activate it but fail to follow it faithfully. The two weak-tier failure modes deserve a beat each, because they're diagnosable in your own system. The first is failure to activate. The relevant skill or memory is sitting right there in the harness, and the agent never retrieves it, never brings it into play. The second is failure to follow. The agent does activate the artifact, pulls the right note into context, and then doesn't actually adhere to it, drifts, ignores it, does its own thing. Those are different bugs with different fixes. One is a retrieval problem, the other an instruction following problem, and lumping them together as the memory didn't help hides which one you have. The implication reframes how you should spend. If updating the harness is easy and roughly capability independent, but benefiting from it requires a capable task solver, then you should invest your capability budget in the agent that does the work, not the agent that does the evolving. You can use a cheap model to write the skills and a strong model to use them. And you should train specifically for harness invocation and long horizon instruction following, the exact things weak models fail at. But the measurement lesson is the one for this episode. When your self-evolving agent's score goes up, you do not know why. Maybe the harness update was good. Maybe the base model was always going to do that. Maybe the agent just did more stuff. Without disentangling updating from benefit, my agent learned is a claim you have not earned. These three papers are academic, but the exact same reckoning is happening in industry right now. And two efforts are worth knowing by name, because they are dragging agent evaluation towards something deserving the word science. The first is a paper called Towards a Science of AI Agent Reliability, from a group including Sayash Kapoor and Arvind Narayanan, who built their reputation puncturing AI hype with careful measurement. Their argument is the thesis of this whole episode, stated for production. Rising accuracy on standard benchmarks suggests rapid progress, yet agents keep failing in practice. And that gap exists because compressing agent behavior into a single success metric obscures the operational details that actually break. Same disease, bigger stakes. The single number flatters the system and hides the failure. The second is an empirical study called Measuring Agents in Production, and it is exactly the grounded evidence the field has been missing. The authors ran 20 in-depth case studies with real agent developers and surveyed 306 practitioners across 26 domains to find out what technical methods actually correlate with successful deployment. Not what should work in theory, what real teams found works. That kind of study, practitioner-grounded, multi-domain, is what turns folklore into knowledge. And the meta point connecting the academic and the industrial, the fix for the measurement crisis is never find the one true benchmark. It is methodological discipline, ground evaluation in execution rather than in how plausible the output looks. Build a small golden set of your own real tasks and replay it every release. Measure across repeated runs because reliability is a distribution, not a single lucky pass. Calibrate your language model judge against human labels before you trust it and report the agreement. And never treat a pass rate as proof of correctness. These are probabilistic systems. Evaluation reduces risk. It does not prove the thing right. If there's one transferable skill from this whole episode, it's the control set, the baselines you run alongside your system so that a gain actually means something. Every paper we've covered across this episode and the last is really an argument for a specific control. Let me assemble the toolkit, because this is the part you can apply Monday. The no-skill control. Run the exact same task with the memory or skill system turned off. If the system on number isn't meaningfully above system off, your memory did nothing, and skill evil bench showed that gap is often smaller than people assume. The raw trajectory control. Compare your distilled memory against just replaying the raw transcript. This is the brutal one from episode 3. Raw often wins, and if you never run it, you'll credit your distillation for gains a dumb log would have given you. the full context control. Compare your clever retrieval against simply stuffing everything into the context window. On the easy benchmarks, full context nearly ties the fancy system, which is how you discover the benchmark is too easy to be telling you anything. The coverage matched query set. Only compare systems on the queries they all had a fair shot at. So you're not secretly grading one system on easier questions. The confound tie app surfaced, the frozen deployment split. Separate the phase where the system learns from the phase where it's tested, and freeze the memory before testing so gains can't sneak in through test time adaptation. And the calibrated judge. Before you trust a language model to score thousands of answers, validate it against human labels on a sample and report the agreement, because judges carry position, verbosity, and self-preference biases, and an uncalibrated judge is just silent drift in your metric. None of these is exotic. They're the agent memory equivalent of a control group and a placebo. The reason they matter so much here is that memory systems are unusually good at looking like they work. The answer comes out right, the demo is impressive, while the underlying memory did little or nothing. Controls are how you tell the difference between a system that remembers and a system that got lucky in front of you. So you have seen the three ways memory benchmarks lie. How should you read a number now without becoming a nihilist about all of them? First, ask for the scoring target. After same ranking, different winner, any memory result without an explicit definition of what counted as a correct retrieval is uninterpretable. Not wrong, uninterpretable. You literally cannot tell what was measured. Second, demand the white box view. After memconflict, an answer-level accuracy number is necessary but not sufficient. Ask whether the right memory was actually retrieved and ranked, separately from whether the answer was right. If a system only reports final answer accuracy, assume it is hiding retrieval failures until proven otherwise. Third, disentangle change from improvement. After harness updating is not harness benefit, be deeply skeptical of any self-improvement claim that does not separate the quality of the update from the capability to use it, and that does not control for the base model. A score that went up after you changed something is not evidence the change helped. Fourth, control your baselines. The connective tissue across this whole episode and the last one is the control set. A no-skill baseline, a raw trajectory baseline, a full context baseline, a coverage-matched query subset. Held out frozen deployment. These are not academic niceties. They are the difference between knowing your system works and hoping it does. And the deeper point, the one I would attach to all of it, these are not reasons to despair about agent memory. They are the field growing up. A discipline becomes a science precisely when it learns the ways its own measurements deceive it and builds the controls to defeat them. Astronomy had to learn about atmospheric distortion. Medicine had to invent the randomized controlled trial. Agent memory is, right now in 2026, inventing its equivalent. The papers in this episode are not the field failing, they are the field becoming trustworthy. The measurement crisis is real, and it is also the most hopeful story in the series, because the same people exposing the lies are handing you the controls. Define the scoring target. Open the black box. Separate updating from benefit. Control your baselines. Do those four things and you can actually trust what you build. One episode left and it is the frontier, forgetting the single least measured part of the entire stack. We will look at stale, a benchmark where the best frontier model scores barely better than a coin flip at noticing its own memories have gone stale. We will look at the strange flood of brain-inspired forgetting designs and the gap between their ambition and their evidence. And we will map the open opportunities, what the field builds next, and where memory and reliability finally merge into one problem. The finale, next time.